We're looking at chapter 19 of the London Baptist Confession of Faith, of the Law of God. And as I was saying before, this is probably one of the chapters that other Christians who are not Reformed would probably find some exception with. The view of the law is one of those things that's hotly debated, even within some churches who are Reformed. The Sovereign Grace Movement, for example, the New Covenant people, take a different view of the law than we would. So this is a very important chapter, and it's important that we understand what our view of the law is. And so let me read the first paragraph, and we'll take this systematically. And again, the outline, you should have outlines. They were made up last week, and you should have a copy of the confession. If you don't have a copy of the confession, remember it's in the back of the Trinity hymnal, so you can always look that up. We are using Sam Waldron's outline as found in his exposition of the 1689. Paragraph 1. God gave to Adam a law of universal obedience, written in his heart, and a particular precept of not eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling, and threatened death upon the breach of it, and endued him with the power and ability to keep it. Okay. Let's look at the outline here. Here we are, the first paragraph. The original dispensation of the law of God. This is the way Waldron has said it. What this sets up is when man was first created, and what was the substance of the law, what was the obligation of the law and its enforcement. And we're going to look at each of those. First, we're going to look at the substance of the law. And we're going to see two things. The substance of the law is this, that it was written in the heart, and there was two aspects to its substance. One, there is a universal law, and the universal law basically is obedience to whatsoever God has said. All right, that I think would be in a nutshell. I think people try to break this up too methodically sometimes, and they'll look at, well God, we have 10 commandments, or we can summarize that in the 2 great commandments. Yeah, and each of those has very particular application, but the bottom line is this: what must we obey? Everything that God tells us to. I mean, that's pretty much it. So if you go to the scriptures and you find something that you're not sure how it relates even to the Ten Commandments, it doesn't matter. If God said it, you obey it. It's that simple, all right? And we're going to see how that comes up, because we have the universal law. Whatever God said to Adam and Eve, they were obligated to obey it. There's a specific precept that was given to Adam and Eve, and that was, don't eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. That was a specific command to them. Now again, notice how that does come under the universal command of obey everything that God says, but here was a very specific command, and that command was directed, of course, first and foremost to them, because it's not a possibility of us not following that command at this point, because we don't have access to that tree any longer. But you see how it works. That was the essence of the original law of God. And something that's built in here too, into the confession, is don't forget that the law of God doesn't change. It was what was given to Adam and Eve, and was written in their hearts, is the essence, and we're going to see this down the line. That's the essence of what was put into the Ten Commandments. And this is where a lot of people make a mistake. they view, we don't have to obey the Ten Commandments. They're not binding upon us. Why? Because, that was the Old Covenant. And then you have some who say, we have to obey all of the commandments, all of those that are repeated in the New Testament. Why? Because they're viewing the Old Covenant, the Ten Commandments, as strictly Old Covenant, and therefore, unless they see a repetition of it, it's not binding upon us anymore. You see how that's just a misunderstanding of the law of God. The law of God never changes. God's word is however he says, or whatever he gave to Adam and Eve, that is binding upon all of their posterity. The fact that God has been gracious at various times to break it down into, firstly, to 10 commandments, with Moses, and then, in various other places, even to Micah, he gives him three things that he should remember, to love mercy, to do justice, and to walk humbly before your God. Those are all commands. All right, and then Jesus breaks it down to two basic commands. That's fine, but it's all part and parcel of the original law of God that doesn't change. All right, and that's what we see. Now we look then at the obligation. The obligation is he bound him and his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience. All right, that's a mouthful. In other words, this is that which binds our conscience. We are bound. Oh, I guess I got to move to the next one here. It's obligation. No. The obligation is that we are bound. This is something that binds our conscience, and that it is personal, entire, exact, perpetual obedience. I mean, that just really sums it up, doesn't it? How many mistakes are you allowed? None. We are bound to keep the law of God personally. That was first put forth to Adam and then to all of his posterity. All right? We following so far? All right? And then still in the first paragraph, the way Walden has it broken out, he talks about its enforcement. And again, this is very simple. Life for obedience, death for disobedience. Again, this isn't rocket science. This is very simple. It's very practical. Whatever we see that is put forth in the law of God, where there's an obligation for us, we are bound to it, to entire and exact obedience, perpetual obedience. And what's the enforcement? Very simple. Obey and you live. Disobey and you die. Again, this is something that's not too difficult. And then the last part of it, he says it's accompaniment, and this is very important. Look at the last phrase of the chapter, of the paragraph, first paragraph, and endued him with power and ability to keep it. Notice, Adam had the ability to keep the law. This was a real possibility for him. Okay? Does everybody follow that? One of the things that was lost when Adam sinned upon all of his posterity, and we went through this in an earlier section of the confession, was the ability to keep the law. You and I don't have that possibility any longer. Because we inherit that sinful nature, we will sin. We are in bondage to sin. Sin is master over us. I'm talking, of course, before salvation. Sin is master over us. Every single person that is conceived is under that curse of sin. Okay? That's the first paragraph. Everybody follow? Any questions on the first paragraph? Okay, let's go to the second paragraph. And it says this: the same law that was first written in the heart of man continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall, and was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written in 2 tables, the first 4 containing our duty towards God and the other 6 our duty to man. All right, so this is how Waldron breaks this down. He calls it the Mosaic codification of the law of God, and this is going to continue for paragraphs 2 through 4. So right now we're just going to be looking at paragraph 2, and what we see, paragraph 2 is the repetition of the moral law. Now notice where he puts this: the law that God gave to Adam and Eve by writing it on their hearts, he gave again. He repeated it to Moses. Okay? And he looks at it in 2 ways: the fact of its reiteration and then the circumstances of its reiteration. Basically, what he's saying is this. And this is, you know, this is so important, because 9 times out of 10, and especially in the dispensational theological construction, they look at the Ten Commandments as being something new. Now, they won't say that, and that's actually not what underpins their theology, but that's the way they react. Pragmatically, that's the way it comes out. Because they pin everything down that the Old Covenant, that was a separate dispensation that was governed by, and they call it the dispensation of law. Okay? And basically what they're saying is that God, at this particular time, was introducing something new. God and man was being dealt with differently than he had been before. Because up until this point, they had 4 other dispensations, which I'm not going to go through. But there were 4 other dispensations, 4 other ways that God has dealt with man coming up to the law. All right? And so now, and that's why, see, there's where you can see where the differences in how we view the law comes in. What we're saying is no. There is no difference. God was just gracious in that he gave it to us in the form of 10 commandments. He spelled it out for us and put it down, wrote it in stone. But was it something new? Were there burdens placed upon the Israelites that were not placed upon all of their predecessors? No. Absolutely not. All 10 of those commandments were functioning prior to Mount Sinai. How do we know that? Well, Cain was held responsible for killing Abel. That certainly was prior to the 10 commandments. Why was Cain punished? Because he violated God's law. I mean, we have all kinds of examples of covetousness, of adultery, of idolatry, long before Mount Sinai. And what did God do? Every time it rose its head, he punished them. Well, if they weren't violations, then why would God punish them? No, of course not. The law was written upon man's heart, starting with Adam and Eve, and all 10 of these commandments were in place right from creation. Okay, does everybody follow that? Because this is crucial for our understanding. And again, this sets us apart from those of us who are Reformed, from virtually every other system of theology that's out there, notably the dispensational. Everybody following? Hello? Okay. All right. And then what he does then, he talks about the repetition of the moral law, and I love the way Waldron puts this. It's a repetition. The Ten Commandments, you know, being written on stone, is not something new. It's being repeated. It's just God's graciousness. And then he says the fact of its reiteration and the circumstances, obviously, that's Mount Sinai. And we all know the story. I mean, every Sunday school child knows the story of Moses going up on the mountain, of his encounter with God, of breaking the tablets, you know, when Israel sins, of him going back up and having, you know, the tablets renewed. I mean, we all know those stories, okay? And so this is a fact, but it's only a reiteration. And, you know, there's even clues in there, you know? And it's interesting. It's interesting that the one commandment that most people tried to get away from, okay, and there's only one, even those in Reformed circles, is the Sabbath command, okay? And that's the one, most specifically, in the Ten Commandments, where God says, remember it. He doesn't institute it. He says, remember it and keep it holy. All right? Clearly indicating that it was functioning long before. Well, we know it was functioning long before. How did we know that? Because before Mount Sinai, when the Israelites were heading towards the Promised Land and they're in the wilderness, there were some instructions. Gather manna for 6 days. Why? Seventh is Sabbath. Don't gather. It's not going to be there. So clearly, the Sabbath command was functioning before the Mosaic dispensation. Okay? And so we see that clearly. That's why I just find it ironic that that's the one that even our Reformed brethren, who are not Sabbatarians, will look at and say, oh, yeah, but it's not repeated in the New Covenant, so therefore we don't have to obey it. Of course, we would disagree with even that, because clearly I think most of us realize that it certainly is reinforced in the New Testament in many places, especially in the book of Hebrews. Okay? But, okay, so that's the first part of that. In paragraph 3... Well, any questions on chapter 2? And again, just one other thing. Notice they put it that the first four containing duties towards God, the other six. There are people who break it up 5 and 5. And I actually lean that way because I look at the commandment of honoring your father and mother as being more towards our duty towards God, because we are, parents are those who are in authority over the children under God. And so I would actually even place that. I think it can easily be placed in the first table and not the second, but it doesn't really matter which way you break it up. Okay? Okay, but I do think the order is important. Okay, but, and we do have a series on the Ten Commandments if you're interested in that. Let's look at paragraph 3 then. Besides the law commonly called moral, God was pleased to give the people of Israel ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws being appointed only to the time of Reformation, are by Jesus Christ, the true Messiah and only lawgiver, who was furnished with power from the Father for that end, abrogated and taken away. Okay? So here now we're looking at the addition of the ceremonial law, and this is paragraph 3. All right? And the way he says it is the purpose of the ceremonial law and then the abrogation of the ceremonial law. And now this is important. One of the things that we need to understand is God has the right to enforce certain laws or even to invoke certain laws that are temporary in nature. Okay? And that's exactly what he did when it came to the ceremonial law. His institution of the priesthood, his institution of the sacrifices, the construction of the temple, you know, all of those things, the articles within the temple, the Ark of the Covenant, all of those things were by design destined to pass away. Because they were given to aid the Israelites in understanding what God's plan was and prefiguring what Christ would accomplish when in the fullness of time he came to earth. Okay, that was the purpose for them. When he gave them, it was given with the understanding that they would not be permanent, that they were types and figures of things that were to come. Okay, and so when in the right time, Christ did come, and he fulfilled the law, for his people, then those ceremonial laws were abrogated because they were no longer necessary, and in fact would be blasphemous if continued. Right? Does everybody understand that? It would be blasphemous for us to come up here this Sunday and instead of having the Lord's Supper that we slaughter a goat or a sheep or an oxen or a ram and say that this is to cover your sin. No. That would be one time I would want to step away thinking that fire from heaven may really come down. Okay. Why? Because Christ did it. So, and this is where some of the confusion comes in about the law of God. You have to look at the law of God from what we would call a tripartite position. And that is, there's actually three specific aspects to God's law, and that's why it's important that when we're doing an exposition, whether it's expository preaching or whether it's teaching in a Bible study, that we understand when we say the words the law of God, what are we talking about? What is the scripture talking about? Because it may not be talking about the same thing every time that phrase is used. Again, context is what's important. All right. And I believe that this too is one of the reasons why so many people confuse the Sabbath day. We need to understand that the Sabbath has two aspects to it. There are ceremonial aspects of the Sabbath day which are no longer binding upon us because it's part of the ceremonial law. In fact, there were other Sabbaths that were included that are not binding upon us. If you go through Leviticus in particular and you look at the Levitical law and you see all of those feasts and festivals, you know, they're not binding. We don't have to celebrate, the Passover. We don't have to celebrate the Feast of Booths. We don't have to celebrate the first fruits. We don't have to do any of those things. And some of them incorporated Sabbath feasts. Okay? Why? Because they're all abrogated. Why? Because Christ fulfilled them all. So what we need to understand is certain aspects of the Sabbath have passed. However, the original mandate of the Sabbath was a creation ordinance. It was not ceremonial in nature, and you need to be able to separate those two. Remember, the Sabbath day was instituted at creation. Okay? At the end of 6 days, God rested and he instituted the Sabbath based upon his work of creation, and that was when the mandate to take that day and keep it holy unto him, that's when that was commanded. Okay? Then we have ceremonial aspects added to it by Moses, you know, in the Levitical law, etc., etc. And so those aspects of it have certainly been abrogated. But the moral command, where this is part of God's moral law and one of the original and perpetual commands, that's binding on us. And we're not left to just surmise that, because there are several portions in the New Testament that reaffirm that. One where we talk of, and where Paul talks about head coverings in 1 Corinthians 11. And this makes no difference about what your view of head coverings is. Okay, so I don't want anybody getting an uproar. We're going to bring up this controversy about head coverings. No, I'm not going to do that. Not that I don't care to discuss it, but that's not what we're looking at here. Whatever your view of head coverings is, Paul says that the reason that you are to obey this is because of the created order. Because Adam was created first and then Eve. That's what he points to. He says this is a creation ordinance. The man, then the woman. He does the same thing in Timothy, where he says that he doesn't allow a woman to exercise authority over a man in the church. Why? And he doesn't go back to cultural norms or Levitical teaching. He goes back to creation, and he says, because Adam was created first, and it was Eve who was deceived. Those are, see, so we find out that there are certain things that when they are binding upon us, when they are rooted in the creation ordinance, and those things will last forever, or at least until Christ comes. Those are perpetual. And I understand a little bit why the Sabbath gets confusing, because there are ceremonial aspects to it that have been abrogated, but the main command of the Sabbath is not. And that's the way the confession holds it, which is the position that we take, obviously, because we subscribe, you know, to the 1689. There's some real good theologians and pastors and churches out there who take a different view, but we just respectfully disagree with them. Any questions on that aspect of it? Because I know that is a sticky subject, because we have so many Sovereign Grace churches who we love these people. We fellowship with, and 99% of our doctrine, we're right in agreement with them. But this is where we part with them on this one point. And that is the stance that we have officially taken in this church. Let me say this too. If somebody comes in that holds a slightly different view, we don't tell them, no, I'm sorry, you can't worship here. I think there are far too many points of agreement, and that even if we come to some sort of disagreement over these, we certainly, you know, have room to have people come into our fellowship here who may not necessarily agree with every single point of the confession. What is necessary for us to belong to ARBCA is that the eldership holds to every one of the points of the confession. And I do. I can say that with a clear conscience. I do. From my heart, I don't like some of the wording of some of the paragraphs of the confession, and I am one of those who would love to see the confession modernized and updated and actually a couple of chapters added to it. I think we need a chapter on marriage and divorce, because I think that's rampant in the church today, and the confession is silent. I think we need a chapter in there on the gifts. And the confession is silent on it, you know. So I think that it's time for an update. But as it is, it's a great document, and I can wholeheartedly, you know, say to you that I'm a full subscriptionist, you know, to the 1689. And I can say that because I was before I ever read the 1689. Okay? Any questions on paragraph 3? Okay? All right, then let's move to the next paragraph, which is paragraph 4. And here we see this third leg of the law of God, and that's the judicial law. So let me read paragraph 4. To them also he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, their general equity only being of moral use. Okay? What this is talking about is all of those laws that we read in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, where we find out we have laws such as, you know, don't yoke your oxen and your donkey together. We find that you must, if you have a on your roof, you must build a parapet around your roof. That we have the laws of what is the punishment if your ox gores somebody, what are the obligations upon the person, what happens if it happens a second time. Okay, we have all kinds of laws in there. Okay. Which are called the judicial laws, which for the most part have an exact punishment that tells you in there what is the punishment, you know, for those. What the confession is saying is simply this. Those laws were, because Israel was a theocratic nation, it was ruled directly by God. Now obviously they had at some point judges or prophets and then later on kings, who worked underneath God, but nonetheless it was ruled by God. God had chosen them as a nation, all right, and he gave them the laws that he expected them to obey. And that came right down to the everyday laws, just as we have penal laws and civil laws in our country today. All right, so everybody understand that part of it? Okay. Now, what the confession goes on further to say is those laws which God specifically gave to Israel in that context are not binding upon us today. That they also have been abrogated. Okay? Everybody following that? That being said, it gives a little phrase here which is very important. It says, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, their general equity only being of moral use. That's an important phrase. Their general equity only being of moral use. Basically what it's saying is this. While we may not have to enact laws in our society that give the punishment for what happens when your oxen gores somebody, the principles that God gave in those laws are for our use today. And let me use that one as an example. Basically what happened, if the first time an Israelite's oxen broke out of its cage and gored somebody, there was a certain punishment. And usually at that point there was a restitution that needed to be made, etc. The second time, and I may be wrong, but the punishment was more severe, and at some point it may even involve the death of the person. Now, I didn't review that for today, so I'm not sure if that's the one that I'm thinking of or not. But in other words, if it happens more than once, your liability is greater. Well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? We actually have laws in our society that are based upon that. In other words, the culpability of the person involved. Let me take homicide laws because that's something that I have a little bit of experience with. If you intentionally take the life of a person in this state, that is a capital crime, and which is actually punishable by either life imprisonment or death. Okay, whether or not they ever use the death penalty is another story, but that's what the penalties are. However, if you recklessly cause the death of another person, that's considered manslaughter, and they don't put you in prison for life, nor will they take your own life, but you get a reduced sentence. It usually at this point it's for man, and there's 2 degrees of manslaughter too, and I think the upper one it's might be like 5 to 15, something like that. Okay, then there's actually a lesser degree of homicide that's called criminally negligent homicide, which is even a lower punishment. And what that's saying is that, you know, you weren't reckless, but you were negligent. And that would kind of be where you leave your fence gate open and your bull goes out and gores somebody. All right? You should have known. But if you do it more than once, for example, let me say this too. Our DWI laws are this way, and especially where it comes to homicide. If you kill somebody, if you operate your vehicle under the influence of alcohol and you kill somebody, you may be charged with manslaughter. May is the operative word. If you do it again, you may be charged with murder, because there's a statute in there, under conditions evincing a depraved indifference to human life, you recklessly engage in conduct. So if you do something that is so outlandish that it shows no concern for human life, they actually raise that to the murder level. All right? So even though it's reckless conduct, but it's more than just reckless conduct, it's reckless conduct that is so out of the norm that you're showing that you don't care if somebody gets hurt. This is like shooting into a crowd of people. You can't say that you intentionally shot somebody, but clearly you should have known somebody could have gotten killed, and by you shooting into a crowd, and if somebody dies, you will more than likely be charged with murder. You follow that? That's what God did in his judicial laws. He put those things in. And where we can take from that judicial law and incorporate those principles, because God does this infallibly, certainly our laws will improve. And that's the relationship of the judicial law. How should the judicial law of Israel apply to us? We don't just throw it out. We look and we see how can we improve our moral laws, our civil laws, based upon what God gave to Israel. But we do have a group of people today who say, no, we need to take all of those judicial laws of Israel and we need to enact them in the United States today. And we say, no, that's not what it says. All right, you know, we actually ran over just a couple of minutes. That brings us up to paragraph 4. Any questions on this aspect of the law? No? We good? You got it, or did I thoroughly confuse you? Huh? Okay. Joe, would you close us in a word of prayer?